Subtitle is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.
The year is 1903. A Czech woman called Olga Janáčková is dying from typhoid fever. She's young, just 20. As she lies in bed in the final days of her life, Olga speaks, just a few words at a time. Her father is sitting by her, listening to these near-death utterances. He's a composer. You may have heard of him, Leoš Janáček. His heart is doubtless breaking, but he's also an artist. He wants to render all aspects of life, even this, into some kind of musical expression. So he takes notes. He writes down his daughter's words, and then he transforms them into music. This is one of what Janáček called Olga's speech melodies. It's played by cellist Petronella Torin. Petronella may be uniquely qualified to interpret these speech melodies because of her own experience with people approaching death.
I have been working with people in palliative care, so I kind of know that they are not themselves for a long time when they are dying. And then just before they're dying, they get this kind of energy boost that all of a sudden they are clear and they are there, and then they die. It's very common that they have like this moment of coming back, and then when that's gone, then it's time.
Did you bring your work as a nurse into the interpretation too?
That's Michael Erard, a linguist and language journalist.
Yeah, I think it's impossible not to. Yeah. I don't know how not to do that.
Janáček made about a dozen speech melodies based on Olga's words and sighs and other sounds. Michael Erard found translations of them in a scholarly article, but he didn't know what they sounded like, which is why he went to Petronella and asked her to play the speech melodies. From Quiet Juice and the Linguistic Society of America, this is Subtitle, stories about languages and the people who speak them. In this episode, the words that mark the end of our linguistic lives, how we value them, and how we sometimes misunderstand them. And if you're thinking, haven't I already heard a Subtitle episode about last words? Well, yes, you have. We did one a while back, but I'm revisiting it with some new material. Michael Erard has a book out now about people's last words and their first words. It's called Bye Bye, I Love You. And when Michael came to me with these recordings of Petronella playing Janáček's speech melodies of his dying daughter, I knew we had to do another episode. Usually when Petronella's asked to play a certain piece of music, she doesn't know the backstory of how it came into being.
A lot of the time you just get music. There is nothing written, and you don't know what it means.
But with these speech melodies, she knows a lot about them.
Here I have a text and I have a context. I know it's a dying girl talking with her father. I have so much material.
So she's got biographical info, as well as her own experience in palliative care. It's hard to know if all that knowledge makes it easier to interpret the music or is a burden.
Should I play the first one? Should we
sure.
have a little taste of it
yeah.
now? She's lying down and she says, I don't want to die, I want to live. What I feel here is that it's a little bit of despair, you know? She wants to live, she's too young to die, she wants to live. But you can choose for yourself what you think, but...
Listen to this first speech melody one more time.
And then the second one, she says, such fear, I will resist it.
So a little bit of fighting spirit, no?
What does that sound like?
And that's hopeful.
It is.
Da, 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 da.
The next one is actually for another set of phrases, which is a repetition, where she says, I am dying, I am dying.
Yeah.
And then the notation says she repeated this until it was incomprehensible.
Ah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So could you play the incomprehensibility? What would that sound like?
Yes.
Wow, yeah.
This one is hard because I didn't know if I should do it like I experience when people die. Because I was working with very sick people. They might have done this. Da da. Da da. So it might have been like this for her as well. Da da. And then she wakes up again and da da. It's like a battery who's going down, you know?
It's hard not to be moved by this, especially with Petronella's interpretation of those final moments. As she plays, she also draws on another memory.
My father died when I was 7, and I can remember that day when I couldn't remember his voice anymore. That day was like, I got a bit crazy, and I was like looking for videotapes. I really felt a loss, like I don't remember my own father's voice anymore. I can imagine for someone who works with sound, and if you don't have a recording device, video or something, it's like, I want to remember, I want to keep this memory. It was just maybe for himself, not to forget.
That strikes a chord for Michael. For years, as he wrote his book, he encountered numerous stories of people's final moments. And there's always more than one person in those moments. Petronella and her father, Janáček and Olga. As Michael puts it, Janáček was as present in those brief melodies as Olga was.
And I feel like that, that it's still his writing, his words about what happened, his idea. So you play her, but in his memory?
There is a final speech melody, very much one you can tell is the final one. By this time, Olga was receiving pain-killing injections.
And then she gets another injection.
Mm.
And she says what's transcribed in English as, whew.
Yeah.
Like a relief.
Yeah.
But that's not notated. And then there's something that is notated, the final sighs. And then he writes, and these are his words, God be with you, my darling.
Yeah.
These speech melodies, as poignant as they were also controversial.
My name is Michael Beckerman. I'm a music historian at New York University. And I first started studying Janáček's work seriously around 1974. And I've spent years and years thinking about him.
Janáček is one of the most famous Czech composers. He composed symphonies and operas, and also thousands of speech melodies, notations of all kinds of sounds he encountered, animal calls, ocean waves, but especially people's voices.
This is a kind of profound early form of recording. On the one hand, they're a record of speech. On the other hand, Janáček modeled them and used them in his musical compositions. You know, the compressed nature of the speech melodies was the atomic particle from which his music evolved. And so all of it has a sense of communicating an enormous amount in a very short span of time.
These speech melodies were groundbreaking, but not controversial, except for the Olga ones.
Some people are kind of vaguely appalled by that. What, like your daughter's dying and you're like taking down notes? Are you nuts? What are you doing? You know, I think that was one reaction.
It's not Beckerman's reaction, though.
I have no reason to come to a conclusion that it was anything but the story that one might want to tell of a deeply moving grieving father, finding some way to, even after death, to preserve some aspect of his daughter.
Which is why so many people try to remember a loved one's last words. Maybe they're not as wrenching as young Olga's final sighs, but often they are. Michael Erard has read and heard far more of these stories than most of us. Not only that, he's studied the research and done some of his own on the condition of the mind and body at the end of life. So after the break, I'll run the earlier episode I did with Michael and several other guests. It's about the meaning of people's last words and how we, the living, interpret those words, for better or worse. That's coming up in a minute. Jumping in here to tell you about a podcast I think you'll like. It's called Feet in Two Worlds, and as the name implies, it's about immigrants. Feet in Two Worlds has a new series out called The Hustle, which tells stories about how immigrants in the US are coping with a changing economy and with some pretty stiff political headwinds. You'll hear how recently settled Venezuelans in Denver are rethinking their future plans, how some New York-based immigrants have found work in a newly legal industry, selling marijuana. Also, episodes from the past that remain relevant today, like the story from 1885 of a massacre of 28 Chinese coal miners in Wyoming. The legal aftermath unexpectedly resulted in reparations. The series is called The Hustle. Find it wherever you're listening to this by searching for Feet in Two Worlds. That's Feet in the numeral two worlds. In 2012, Michael Erard was living in Portland, Maine. He was foraging for wild blackberries on the edge of town one day when something on the ground stopped him short, a set of bones.
You do a lot of hiking in the woods and you come across carcasses, and this just didn't look like bones that I had ever seen before. And it slowly and kind of horrifically dawned on me what this was.
Human remains, a woman. Her name, Michael found out later, was Tanya. She'd been living on the streets and she'd disappeared maybe a year earlier. It wasn't clear exactly when. No one had reported her disappearance to the police. There was no announcement on local news, no search parties.
She just kind of vanished, but she was always invisible, so you can't really say that she vanished. But I found her.
These thoughts, the whole incident, they shook Michael. He came to realize he owed something to Tanya.
So, you know, I did a lot of reading in the anthropology of death and came to understand that there are two deaths. One is the biological death and the other is the social death. And the living are intensely involved in both. And that in some cultures, occasionally you can have circumstances where someone might be trapped between the biological death and the social death. They're physically dead, but they haven't fully been socially sent off. And one of those conditions is when people are sort of unburied. So I had found someone who was in this liminal state.
And because of that circumstance, and also because no cause of death could be determined by the medical examiner, Michael decided to take on certain responsibilities himself.
She was dead, but I needed to sort of do something. And I ended up doing a lot of research, a lot of reporting and writing her story as a way of completing her social death. You know, I sort of thought about what her experience of dying was or what it might have been, you know, and how she came to be there is still a mystery. But thinking about how she was alone, if she was indeed dying in the woods, and that condition of, you know, of dying alone, to me, and I think to a lot of people in America, sort of sounds like the very definition of a bad death, to do that alone. And because she was alone, there was no one there to comfort her, and there was no one there to hear anything that she would say that would be the last sort of message that she would provide.
What did Tanya say at the end of her life, if she said anything? That, for Michael, was as big a mystery as all the others. Hearing someone's last words or reading about them, it acts as, I don't know, comfort, connection. It does seem to be very much a part of the social death. We can think about those words, talk about them with others, try to interpret them. With Tanya, none of that was possible. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered. Sometimes, often, witnesses at the deathbed, they don't fully understand what their loved one is actually saying, because the words appear to make no sense, or they're barely whispered, impossible to make out. But still, we, the people left behind by the dying, we feel the need to witness and record and cherish those words. Okay, a quick note here. Usually, we strive to maintain a consistent tone throughout an episode. With this one, though, we're not even going to try to do that. Death, loved ones, and language, that's just too unstable a compound. You've been warned.
Hi, Patrick.
It's Kavita Pillay, who's here to help me with Chapter 1. Chapter 1, a quiz. Okay, so I've got some quotes here. They're all last words of famous people who supposedly said them just right before they popped off.
Okay.
I would like you to guess or to tell me if you know which famous person said each of them.
All right, I'll give it a go.
And I will reveal the answers at the end of the episode.
I have to wait that long.
Afraid so.
Okay.
Number one, all my possessions for a moment of time.
All my possessions, that's it?
That's it.
All my possessions for a moment of time. Okay, so it's someone with a lot of possessions? I don't know. I'm going to say Cleopatra.
Okay, I'm not going to tell you if you're right or not. I'm just going to move right along.
All right.
Number two. This is actually my favorite deathbed quote. This was in response to a question from somebody, a friend or family member, who was asking how this person was. Here goes. I am dying, but otherwise quite well.
Oh, very dry humor up till the end. I'm tempted to say Cleopatra for all of these, but at some point it's going to be Cleopatra. So who would have such wit at the end of their life? Let's say Bob Hope.
Another good guess. Let's go on to the next one. This was someone who died in a shabby hotel room. Either that wallpaper goes, or I do.
Oh, this one I know because it's so great. It's so famous. It's Oscar Wilde.
That's right. He died in poverty in a hotel in Paris in 1900.
Such a great quote. Whether or not he actually said it, I mean, is it known whether he actually said this, or is this one of those apocryphal deathbed quotes?
I will reveal that too at the end of the episode.
Okay.
Number four is extremely short. I'm bored.
Wow. I'm bored. What I would like guess on this, I'm going to think it was someone who was very exciting in life. Can I get a hint, like what part of the world?
Yeah, this is an American writer, and I can give you the year, 1987.
Oh, 87, American writer. I'm going to say Philip Roth. I have no idea. I don't remember when he died.
It was not Philip Roth, although I imagine that Philip Roth may well have been extremely bored when he died. It's a boring thing to do for most, especially if it's prolonged.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Number five. This is also kind of a favorite of mine, although this is not a long time favorite. I only came across it when I was researching this episode. You are supposed to say beautiful things and you can't.
Oh, okay. That's it. You are supposed to say beautiful things and you can't.
This is unfair, this one, because you're not going to know who this was. I didn't even know this person existed, although in her country, I think everybody knew her.
Okay. Tell me the country, if you will.
Yes, of course. Romania.
Oh, goodness. I have no idea. I think I could have come up with something if I was just guessing without that hint. I really have no idea. I couldn't even make something up, I don't think.
I would accept a title without the name.
A title? You mean like a like some sort of royalty?
Ding, 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 ding. Yes. It's Queen Elizabeth of Romania, who died in 1916. And I feel so sorry for her, if that indeed was her last spoken thought.
That's pretty rough. Obviously, she lived a life of in the limelight with a lot of pressure till the end.
Till the end. I don't know about you, but no one I know has ever overheard a dying loved one say something deep or mystical at the very end, or crack a joke. Maybe Queen Elizabeth of Romania didn't realize that those kind of pronouncements from other people, a lot of them at least, they're invented by others, or at the very least, conceived and rehearsed in healthier, earlier days. Maybe she thought these aphorisms and witticisms arrived spur of the moment, on the lips of the dying, as a final inspiration. So instead, she's left with her final disappointment that she couldn't come up with anything. You are supposed to say beautiful things and you can't. But what do we know? Maybe the context was totally different. Maybe Queen Elizabeth of Romania was speaking to her speechwriter, whose job it was to make her sound profound and regal. Maybe she was accusing the speechwriter of having writer's block at the most key of moments. You are supposed to say beautiful things, and you can't. It works that way too. Sadly, though, there is no mention in the history books of a speechwriter. Instead, we learn that not only was Elizabeth no longer queen when she said those words, she lost the title 2 years before when her husband died, but she was supposedly saying those words to her successor, the new queen, Marie. No wonder she was at a loss for words. Chapter 2, Whispered in My Ear. Tanmoy Goswami is the founder of Sanity, an independent mental health journalism platform in India. He told me this story from his home in Delhi, in the middle of a heat wave, which accounts for the noise of the fan in the background.
When I was really young, maybe about, I was about 8 or 10 years old, that's when I experienced the first death, sort of firsthand in my family, when my grandfather passed away. And just before he died, he called me, and he was very, very old and very ill. And he kind of whispered in my ears. And it's funny because I have not remembered or told this story to anybody in a long, long time. He called me and he whispered in my ears the names of sort of his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. I was 10, like I said. I don't remember. I probably remember one or two names. But I told my father that he had done that, and my father was very moved, because I think what was obviously happening there was he was trying to make sure that somebody after him knows where his lineage comes from. Of course, only the men, there was no mention of women. That was the first time that I got a taste, and I can only say this in retrospect, of course, of how important it is to witness somebody's last words. That is hard to forget, I think.
Chapter 3, First Words. Michael Irad didn't just wonder about the last words of Tanya, whose remains he'd discovered in the Maine woods. He found himself thinking about first words, too.
You know, I later came to find out that she had kids of her own, and that they had, you know, first words. Maybe she remembered them, maybe she didn't. If she did, when she died, that knowledge sort of disappeared. That passed away as well.
Michael's discovery of Tanya came at a pivotal point in his life.
It was a couple of years after that whole experience of trying to understand why I was so unsettled by it that that I had another baby. So it was kind of this really intense experience with mortality, sandwiched by the arrival of two children who were using language for the first time.
Just to be clear, this is not Michael's family. But you know the scene. Excited baby, even more excited parent. It was like that for Michael too, with his older son.
He was about 13 months old, and he was lying on his back on a bed, and we were at a small hotel in Canada, which is only relevant because there was a ceiling fan above the bed, which we don't have at home. And this was a baby who was fascinated by things that went around. Fans, wheels, propellers. And I was changing his diaper, and he was saying, "Wound, wound, wound, wound." And we must have pointed those things out, you know, fans, and said, "Oh, it's going around and around." And I stopped and I said, "Are you saying round, round?" And it was like suddenly occurred to me, this might be a production.
Something he was actively trying to say, and something that his father responded to.
He got this big smile on his face. And it was actually the smile in some ways that was the confirmation that I had accurately perceived and identified the thing that he had intended to say, to point out to me. And it was like, "Wow, you said round, round." And he was really happy that I recognized that.
But was that the first word? Michael's not sure. There were earlier things he said too, like car. He said that a lot, often pointing at random things. It didn't seem to have a fixed meaning.
But it was probably something like, "Hey, look at that." Now, why he would choose ka for that, I don't know. But that was the thing that he regularly said over and over.
Does that meet the definition of a word? I mean, ka meant something. It was intended to draw attention to things. It was part of an interaction. But at the time, it didn't strike Michael as that moment, you know, when a human crosses the linguistic threshold.
Because I was obsessed with trying to, like, be there for the emergence of this thing and to know, oh, here I am on this side and I lived through it and now I'm on the other side of this. But I missed it entirely. Like, we didn't celebrate that. We were scratching our heads.
There were sounds before that too. Things like eh. Words? No. But Michael's son did produce these vocalizations for a reason.
He was manipulating our attention. He was recognizing that we were looking at the same thing, and the same thing that we were looking at was each other, which was now, you know, in retrospect, really was the dawn of something that was significant, and that things were from there about to change in some interesting ways. I kind of came to that first experience with parenting, with this idea that when he uses words, then I'll really know who he is. Then we'll really be able to connect. But in some ways, I really found that in the year that it took for him to say eh and ka and finally round round, that I didn't need them. There were so many other ways of understanding his emotional state, his physical needs, his feelings of connection to me and to indicating my connection to him, that the words as a thing really weren't that important. And that happens at the end of life as well.
Chapter 4, The Diversity of Death. There are many ways to die, and just as many ways to interpret what the dying are saying. Steve Jobs had pancreatic cancer. His last reported words were, "Oh wow, oh wow, oh wow." Of course, I've got no idea how he said those words. Was he looking back on his life or being transported into a new reality? Was he responding to pain or was he delirious? Other last words are more concrete, much more, reminders of how cruelly people have died. "I can't breathe." Those are words with a clear intention, an appeal to be allowed to breathe. Now, because the people who said them weren't allowed to breathe, the words have taken on new meanings or subtexts. No more police brutality, end societal racism. Don't let those ever be anyone's last words again. And then there are people's last words online.
So Patrick, to be honest with you, I had been thinking about our last digital footprints for a while now.
This is Shefali Bhatt, a journalist with the Indian publication Mint. She reports on how the internet is changing how we live. And that term she uses, last digital footprint, it's disconcerting. I don't know about you, but I don't especially like the idea of being memorialized via Google searches or my latest tweets.
There was somebody who was a year younger than me who passed away earlier this year.
Someone who worked in tech, who tweeted a lot.
Their last tweet was actually about hiring dilemmas, a hot topic in the tech industry. So a lot of people participated, engaged with that tweet. A few days after they tweeted that, they passed away of a cardiac arrest. And a lot of people who didn't know about it saw that tweet on their timeline and would respond.
The comments, the conversation, they continue for days. Occasionally someone would chime in saying the person had died. But a lot of people just continued the original conversation about jobs in the tech industry.
And then an internet service company that this person had once worked with put out a tweet saying that this person was once a part of our, you know, organization and we pay our condolences. And as is the practice with the internet, right? People just see a tweet from a service company and without looking at the context, they just start complaining about the bad service that that company has. It's just very disrespectful to the last memories of that person. And I think that really pained me to, you know, to see what was happening.
Even now, months later, Shefali is haunted by this arbitrary, misplaced reaction to a person's last digital footprint. She says she still doesn't know what to make of it. The circumstances are just too new.
There are so many ways that it affects you, but how it affects you is something which is very hard to explain.
Chapter 5. Hello, goodbye. Among the new end-of-life situations we faced during the pandemic was the presence of technology as a form of communication. Betsy Roslin is a registered nurse who, during part of that time, worked in end-of-life care.
We had, iPads and we did FaceTime.
Listening to Betsy, the presence of devices and the internet in those final interactions doesn't seem that novel anymore. We're already used to the idea of it.
It is different talking to someone through a screen rather than having someone hold their loved one's hands. That's sort of the hallmark of intimacy at that stage. Even when the words have gone, touch is really important and hearing, you know, loud and clear from people that want to say their goodbyes. And of course, they were doing it over a screen. It was hard.
It also made for hard decisions from the hospice nurses who themselves feared infection.
So everyone was pretty terrified. I can think of some people that did pass away at our facility, and we wouldn't let any visitors in. One was a 40-year-old man, and I made the decision to admit him to a room that had a window that was directly to the outside. We were used to having a lot of visitors, but we couldn't allow them in based on what our director had mandated. And I opened the window, but there was still a screen there. And, you know, it was very difficult. If I had to do it again, I probably would have just let them in and dealt with the consequences. As it was, someone questioned my judgment in even opening the window. And I thought, my goodness, you know, here's this mother trying to touch her son through a screen. And even though we had pushed the bed as close as possible, it seemed really distant.
Did you witness, I wouldn't ask you to relate specifically what people said to each other, but was the nature of how people may have said their goodbyes or what they said, was that different because of those circumstances?
I think it was. I think it was a lot more tearful. There was an extra level of heartache. It was still something that just made that last interaction so distant. You know, literally, the next time they would see this loved one would be at the funeral home. So there was this whole missing piece of the puzzle that is very important when that is the last time they would ever have a chance to see each other.
That's so interesting that you put it that way. And you said before how important touch was. I mean, here am I doing a story about last words, and it sounds as though there's a whole missing bit there, which is between those last words and, as you say, the funeral hum. And a lot of us have experienced precisely that. I mean, my last week with my dad was entirely without verbal communication, and yet there was plenty of communication. It was just gestural, or, you know, squeezes, hand squeezes, and those kinds of things.
I think touch is very important, and, you know, a cool cloth on someone's brow, sponging their parched lips, you know, there's a lot of intimacy in that, and so all of that was taken away.
Betsy says the way we die varies, of course, from one person to the next. But like everyone who's been around it a lot, she sees patterns.
There's a description called the laboring process of death, and much like a woman going into labor and experiencing the contractions, and there's a flow to it with an expectation at the end of a birth. This is a patient transitions from a state of functioning organs to a literal shutting down somewhat systematically. Words can come back, but I don't think they would be a sentence. It might be, you know, monosyllables, a repetitive word, or I've read that people will say mama or things like that, and they lack the strength to actually get a verbalization out. You know, their vocal cords fail them at that point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you should say mama, because one thinks of that more as typically as a first word.
That's true.
We are such a word-oriented culture, and we are such a speech-oriented culture. Words, and legible words to which we can attribute some sort of intention will always take precedence over other sorts of behaviors.
We have to beat back words, Michael Arad says, or at least understand them for what they are. And sometimes they don't have much to do with what they're supposed to mean.
There's a whole set of things that happen at the end of life which are kind of problematic, such as delirious language. Are the things that someone says when they're delirious, are they intentional? Is it that person speaking? You'll hear phrases like, that's not your father, that's the disease. Or your father is not saying that, your father is gone. So you don't have to be troubled by what it is that you're hearing. But in the same way that when you look at observations of children's early communicative behavior, the emergence of early vocabulary, it's not a straight line.
Not a straight line, but a gradient. At the beginning of life, words are thrown out into the air, sometimes with meaning, sometimes without, and bit by bit, they acquire what we think of as sense. It may be an indication that the person speaking is behaving less as an organism, more as their own self. The reverse happens at the end of life, as words become detached from their semantic meaning, though they may still have some sort of meaning, especially when combined with groans, sighs, gestures, eye contact, and all kinds of other communication cues that aren't rooted in language.
So it opens up the possibility of considering other sorts of behaviors as like an articulation of consciousness, as a final articulation of who that person is. That's not just the witticism, or is not just, you know, a word, but is someone told me a story about a father, not very old, who was dying of cancer and wasn't able to verbalize anything, but sort of opened his eyes and very intently, he had his daughters, who were quite young, at the bed and sort of just looked at each of them one after another, very intently, and then he passed away.
Michael Arad is writing a book about all this, Last Words and First. He owes a lot, he says, to Tanya. Finding what was left of her in the woods, he knew he had that responsibility that he talked about, to help give her a social death. But also, he'd never met her. He didn't know her. And that's why that encounter opened a door, he says, when it came to starting to write about death and words.
Because I had no connection to her, I don't need my discussion of dying and death to reflect anything that I need from her. I don't need to connect to her specifically through these ideas or what I'm writing about. Sometimes, and I'm probably not going to say this right, but sometimes I feel like people who get interested in death and dying are doing so because someone close to them has passed away and they're still processing that personal loss at the same time that they're learning about death and dying. You know, one of the gifts that I think that Tanya gave to me was opening the door to the topic, but without that personal grief. It was a grief for sure, but it wasn't a personal one.
Michael Erard, his book Bye Bye I Love You is out now. Many thanks to Michael. Also to Tonmoy Goshvani, Shefali Butt, and Betsy Roslin. Special thanks to Henry Sessions. Kavita Pillay is Subtitle's co-host and sometime quiz contestant. The answers to the quiz, by the way, are coming up in a minute or so. Tina Toby is our sound designer. Alison Shao manages our social media and newsletter, which you can sign up for at subtitlepod.com/newsletter. That's subtitlepod.com/newsletter. Subtitle is a member of the Hub and Spoke Audio Collective. We're a bunch of podcasters who are dedicated to telling stories about stuff that you won't come across in many other places. Here's one of the other Hub and Spoke podcasts, Ministry of Ideas. On one of my favorite episodes, host Zachary Davis explores the complex nature of national borders and discovers that they're not really the fixed lines on a map that some of us may imagine them to be. Listen to Ministry of Ideas and all of the Hub and Spoke podcasts at hubspokeaudio.org. Thanks for listening. Now for the quiz answers. Kavi.
Let's do it.
All my possessions for a moment of time?
I said Cleopatra.
You said Cleopatra. It was Queen Elizabeth I of England.
Okay, so I was on the right track.
Number two, this was the one that's my favorite. In response to a question about how this person was, I am dying, but otherwise quite well. This was the British poet and critic Edith Sitwell, who died in 1964.
Good quote. I wouldn't have known it.
Okay, number three, you got right. That was the Oscar Wilde quote when he, just before he died in 1900, either that wallpaper goes or I do. That particular quote is probably not those words. It may have only appeared in a letter that he wrote. There's all kinds of different stories about that. Mm-hmm. So as there are with the other ones, the Queen Elizabeth I, I don't think many people think that she actually said that, but it was said on her behalf, perhaps. Mm. Okay, number four was I'm Bored, American author yes. and activist, died in 1987, James Baldwin.
Oh, wow. I would not have paired up James Baldwin with that quote.
I think everything in his whole world moved at great speed and with great passion, and dying probably was a bit of a letdown.
Mm.
Who knows? And number five, which you got right again, you're supposed to say beautiful things and you can't. Queen Elizabeth of Romania, who died in 1916. A bonus quote for you now, just so we don't end on a total bummer.
Mm.
This was from 1994, and here's the quote. I want the world to be filled with white, fluffy duckies.
Oh, what a lovely thought on your way out. Could you say it again? Lovely, fluffy duckies?
I want the world to be filled with white, fluffy duckies.
Oh, white, fluffy duckies. Is this a person who was somehow known for
yes.
duckies?
No, not to my knowledge. This was a person who dreamed up kind of very Baroque images. So it's, in that sense, it is in keeping.
Okay. So someone creative.
Yes.
Any other hints?
He was a filmmaker, a British filmmaker who made kind of art films that sometimes sort of entered, not exactly the mainstream, but they were successes.
Oh, film, let's see. It wasn't...
I got a barking dog in the background.
Oh, yeah, I hear.
Louis, have you got the answer?
Oh, sweet.
His name is Derek Jarman.
Oh, yeah, I would not have known that. But it's a great quote.
His world may now be filled with white fluffy duckies.
No, let's hope. I hope he got his wish.
Subtitle is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.